back in our cabs. All day I can't help thinking about it. I also dread the other two addresses, although part of me explains that they can't be any worse than the first one. I go there every night as gradually the moon goes through its cycle. Sometimes it doesn't happen. Sometimes he comes home and there's no violence. On those nights, the silence of the street is swollen. It's scared and slippery as I wait for something to happen. A nervous moment arrives one afternoon when I go shopping. I'm walking along the dog food section when a woman walks past me with a little girl sitting in the trolley. "Angelina," she says, "don't touch that." The voice is mild but unmistakable. It's the voice that calls to the night for help when she's slumped down on the bed, being raped by a drunk with a libido like Kilimanjaro. It's the voice of a woman who quietly sobs on her front porch in the silent, uncaring night. For a split second, the girl and I lock eyes. She's blonde with green eyes and beautiful. The mother's the same, only tiredness has worn down her face. I follow them a while, and once, when the mother's crouched down looking at packet soups, I see her fall silently to pieces. She crouches there, dying to fall to her knees but not allowing herself. When she stands back up, I'm there. I'm there and we stare and I say, "You okay?" She nods and lies. "I'm okay." I have to do something soon. Seven of Diamonds, Harrison Avenue. At this point, you can probably tell what I've decided to do about the whole Edgar Street situation. Or at least you'll know if you're anything like me. Cowardly, meek, positively weak. Of course, in my infinite wisdom, I'm choosing to leave it for a while. You never know, Ed. Might just work itself out. Now, I know that's pathetic in just about its purest form, but there's no way I can deal with this kind of thing so early. I need experience with this. I need a few wins under my belt before I can test myself against the rapist built like Tyson. I pull out the cardigan one night as I drink coffee with the doorman. I gave him some Blend 43 the previous night and he was quite taken by it. At first, he wouldn't touch it. He looked at me, he looked at his bowl, back and forth. It took me nearly 5 minutes to realize that he saw me putting sugar in my mug that says taxi drivers aren't the biggest shitheads on the road. Once I gave him some sugar, he became much more enthusiastic. He slurped and licked and carried on, demolishing the entire bowl and looking up for more. So, it's the doorman and me in the lounge room. He's going at his coffee while I stare at the card at the other addresses. 13 Harrison is next on the list, and I make my mind up to go there the next evening, 6 o'clock sharp. "What do you say, doorman?" I ask. "This one will be better, you reckon?" He gives me a grin because he's all hopped up on the Blend 43.
"I'm telling you," Marv points his finger at Richie. "I did knock. I don't care what you say."
"Did he knock?" Richie asks me. I can't remember.
"Audrey?"
She thinks a moment and shakes her head. Marv throws his hands in the air. He has to pick up 4 cards now. In annoyance, that's the way it works. You get down to 2 cards and you knock. If you forget to knock before you put down that second to last card, you pick up 4. Marv forgets to knock quite frequently. He scowls as he picks up the cards, but secretly he's trying not to laugh. He knows he didn't knock, but he'll always try to get away with it. It's part of the game. We're at Audrey's place, on her balcony. It's dark, but the floodlights are on, and people look up as they walk past a lot of townhouses. It's a street around the corner from mine. A bit of a dive, but nice enough. In the first hour of play, I look at Audrey and know that I'm in nervous love with her. Nervous because I don't know what to do sometimes. I don't know what to say. What can I tell her when I feel the hunger rise in me? How would she react? I think she's frustrated with me because I could have gone to university and now I just drive a cab. I've read Ulysses, for God's sake, and half the works of Shakespeare. But I'm still hopeless, useless, and practically pointless. I can see she could never really see herself with me. Yet she's still done it with others who are pretty much the same. Sometimes I can't bring myself to think about it. Thinking about what they've done and how it feels and how she likes me too much to consider me. Even though I know, it isn't just sex I'd want from her. I'd want to feel myself mold with her, just for a moment, if that's all I'm allowed. She smiles at me when she wins a round, and I smile back. "Want me," I beg. But nothing comes.
"So whatever happened with that weird card thing?" Marv asks later.
"What?" You know very bloody well what. He points at me with his cigar. He could use a shave. Everyone listens as I lie. I threw it out. Marv approves.
Good idea. Load of shit, that.
Damn right, I agree. End of story. Supposedly. Audrey looks at me, amused. For the next few games, I think of what happened earlier, when I went to 13 Harrison Avenue. I was quite relieved, to tell you the truth, because nothing really happened at all. The only person there was an old woman who has no curtains on her windows. She was in there on her own, making her dinner and sitting there eating and drinking tea. I think she ate a salad and some soup. And loneliness. She ate that, too. I liked her. I stayed in my cab the whole time, sitting there watching her. It was hot, and I drank some old water. Often I hoped the woman was all right. She looked gentle and kind, and I recall the way her old-fashioned kettle whistled till she went over and soothed it. I'm quite sure she spoke to it, like she would to a child, like a baby crying. It kind of depressed me to think a human could be so lonely that she would comfort herself with the company of appliances that whistle and sit alone to eat. Not that I'm much better, mind you. Let's face it. I eat my meals with a 17-year-old dog. We drink coffee together. You'd think we were husband and wife the way we carry on. But still, the old lady did something to my heart. When her hands reached out and poured the tea, it was as if she also poured something into me while I sat there sweating in my cab. It was like she held a string and pulled on it just slightly to open me up. She got in, put a piece of herself inside me, and left again. In there, somewhere, I still feel it. I sit here playing cards, and the image of her is splayed across the table. Only I can see it. I see her hand shaking as she brought the spoon up to her mouth. I want to see her laugh or express some kind of happiness or contentment to let me know she's okay. I soon realize, though, that I have to find out for sure. It's my go.
Your go, Ed.
It's my go, and I'm not going. I'm down to two cards, and I have to knock. The three of clubs and the nine of spades. The only trouble is, I want more cards tonight. I'm not interested in winning. I think I know what I have to do for the old woman, and I make a bet with myself. If I pick up the ace of diamonds, I'm right. If I don't, I'm wrong. I forget to knock, and everyone laughs at me as I go to pick up. First card, queen of clubs. Second card, four of hearts.
Third card, yes.
Everyone wonders why I could possibly be smiling, except Audrey. Audrey winks at me. She knows without asking that I did it on purpose. The ace of diamonds is in my hand. This is much better than Edgar Street. I'm feeling good. It's Tuesday, and I'm putting on my white jeans and my nice sandy-colored boots. I pull out a decent shirt. I've been to the cheesecake shop, having been ably assisted by a girl called Misha.
Don't I know you?
She asks. Maybe, I can't quite...
Of course, you're the guy from the bank. The hero.
The fool, more like it, I thought. But I said, oh yeah, you're the girl from behind the counter. You work here now? She nodded.
Yeah.
She was a bit embarrassed.
I couldn't handle the stress in the bank.
The robbery?
Nah, my boss was a total prick.
The acne and the sweat patches?
Yeah, that's him. Tried to stick his tongue in my mouth the other day.
Ah, well, I said, that's men for you. We're all a bit that way.
Ain't that the truth? But she was friendly from start to finish. When I was outside the shop, she called after me. Enjoy the cake, Ed.
Thanks, Misha. I called back, but not loud enough, probably. I don't like making noise in public. And I was gone. I think about it briefly as I open the box and look at half a mud cake. I feel for the girl because it can't have been too nice having that guy all over her like that, and it was she who quit. The bastard. I'm scared out of my mind before I try to put my tongue in a girl's mouth. And I don't have acne or sweat patches. Just shithouse confidence. That's all. Anyway, I give the cake a last examination. I smell good. I'm decked out in my nicest clothes, ready to go. I step over the doorman and close the door behind me. The day is silver grey and cool as I walk over to Harrison Avenue. I'm there by 6 o'clock, and the old lady is attending to the kettle again. The grass on her front lawn is gold. My feet crunch over it like the sound of someone biting in a toast. My boots seem to leave prints, and I truly feel like I'm walking over a giant piece of toasted bread.
The roses are the only things alive, standing resolutely by the driveway. Her front porch is cement, old and cracked, like mine. The fly screen door is torn at the edges, fraying. I open it and knock on the wood. The sound rhymes with my heartbeat. Her footsteps climb to the door. Her feet sound like the tick-tock of a clock, counting time to this moment. She stands. She looks up at me, and for a moment we both get lost in each other. She wonders who I am, but only for a split second. Then, with stunning realization clambering across her face, she smiles at me. She smiles with such incredible warmth and says, "I knew you'd come, Jimmy." She steps towards me and hugs me hard, her soft, wrinkled arms encasing me. "I knew you'd come." When we move apart, she looks at me again, till a small tear lifts itself up in her eye. It trips out to find a wrinkle and follows it down. "Oh," and she shakes her head. "Thanks, Jimmy. I knew it. I knew it." She takes me by the hand and leads me into the house. "Come in," she tells me. I follow. "Are you staying for dinner, Jimmy?" "Only if you'll have me," I reply. She chuckles. "If you'll have me," she waves me away dismissively. "You're such a card, Jimmy." "Damn right I'm a card." "Of course I'll have you," she continues. "It'll be lovely to go over old times, won't it?" "Of course." She takes the cake from me and puts it in the kitchen. I can hear her mucking around in there, and I call out to see if she needs any help. She tells me I should just relax and make myself comfortable. The dining room and the kitchen both face the street, and as I sit at the dining room table, I see people walk past, rush past, and some wait for their dogs and move on. On the table is a pensioner's card. Her name's Miller. Miller Johnson. She's 82. When she comes back out, she brings a dinner identical to the one she had the previous day. Salad and soup and some tea. We eat, and she tells me all about her day-to-day travels. She talks for 5 minutes to Sid in the butcher's shop, but doesn't buy any meat. Just chats and talks and laughs at his jokes, which aren't really funny. She has lunch at 5 to 12. She sits in the park, watching the kids play and the skateboarders do their tricks and swerves at the skate bowl. She drinks coffee in the afternoon. She watches Wheel of Fortune at 5:30. She has her dinner at 6. She's in bed by 9. Later on, she gives me a question. We've cleaned up the dishes and I'm sitting again at the table. Miller comes back in, nervously sitting in her chair. Her shaking hands reach out to mine. They hold them, and her pleading eyes open me. She says,
"So tell me, Jimmy."
The hands begin to shake a little harder.
"Where have you been all this time?"
Her voice is painful but soft.
"Where have you been?"
Something's stuck in my throat. The words. Finally, I recognize them and say, "I've been looking for you." I speak that sentence as if it's the one great truth I've ever known. She returns my conviction, nodding.
"I thought so."
She pulls my hands over to her, leans over, and kisses my fingers.
"You always did know what to say, didn't you, Jimmy?"
"Yes," I say. "I guess I did." Soon she tells me she has to go to bed. I'm pretty sure she's forgotten about the mud cake, and I'm dying to have some. It's close to 9 o'clock, and I can sense I'm not getting a single crumb of that cake. I feel awful about it, of course. I ask myself what kind of person I am, worrying about missing out on a lousy piece of cake. She comes to me at about 5 to 9 and says,
"I think I should probably go to bed, Jimmy. Do you think?"
I speak softly. "Yes, Miller, I think so." We walk to the door and I kiss her on the cheek. "Thank you for dinner," I say, and walk out.
"My pleasure. Will I see you again?"
"Definitely," I turn and answer. "Soon." The message this time is to soothe this old lady's loneliness. The feeling of it gathers in me as I walk home, and when I see the doorman, I pick him up and hold all 45 kilos of him in my arms. I kiss him in all his filth and stench, and I feel like I could carry the world in my arms tonight. The doorman looks at me with bemusement, then asks, "How about a coffee, old son?" I put him down and laugh and make the old bludger a coffee, with plenty of sugar and milk. "Would you like a coffee too, Jimmy?" I ask myself. "Don't mind if I do," I reply. "Don't mind at all." And I laugh again, feeling every bit like a true messenger.
Eight of diamonds. Being Jimmy. It's been a while since I delivered the coffee table to Ma's place. I haven't dropped in on her for a good couple of weeks, to let her cool down a bit. She gave me a nice drubbing when I finally turned up with it. I visit her on a Saturday morning.
"Well, look what the bloody cat dragged in,"
she says wryly when I walk through the door.
"How's it going, Ed?"
"All right. You?" "Working my freckle off, as usual." Ma works in a gas station behind the register. She does bugger all, but whenever you ask her how she is, she claims to be working her freckle off. She's making some sort of cake that she won't let me have a piece of because someone more important's coming over. Probably someone from the Lions Club or something. I come closer to get a better look at what it is.
"Don't touch,"
she snaps. Not even within reaching distance. "What is it?"
"Cheesecake."
"Who's coming over?"
"The old Marshalls."
Typical. Rednecks from around the corner. But I say nothing. Better off that way. "How's the coffee table going?" I ask. She laughs almost deviously and says,
"Pretty well. Go have another look at it."
I do as she says, walk into the lounge room, and can't trust my eyes. She's done a bloody swap on me.
"Oi!"
I shout to the kitchen. "This isn't the one I delivered." She comes in.
"I know. I decided I didn't like that one."
I've got the shits now. Really. I knocked off work an hour early to pick up that other one, and now it's not good enough for her. What the hell happened?
"I was talking to Tommy on the phone, and he said all that pine rubbish was pretty ordinary and wouldn't last."
She props between sentences.
"And your brother knows about that sort of thing, believe me. He bought himself an old cedar table in the city, talked the guy down to 300 and got the chairs half price."
"So what?"
"So he knows what he's doing. Unlike some people I know."
"You didn't get me to pick it up?"
"Now why in God's name would I do that?"
"You made me get the last one."
"Yeah, but let's face it, Ed," she says. "Your delivery service is a disgrace."
The irony of it isn't lost on me. "Everything okay, Ma?" I ask later. "I'm going to the shops in a minute. Do you need anything?" She thinks.
"Actually, Lee's coming over next week, and I want to make a chocolate hazelnut cake for her and the family. You can get the crushed hazelnuts for me."
"No worries." "Now piss off, Ed," I think as I walk out. It's what she was thinking, I'm sure.
I like being Jimmy. "Remember when you used to read to me, Jimmy?"
"I remember," I reply. Needless to say, I'm at Miller's place again, in the evening. She reaches out her hand and holds me by the arm.
"Could you pick up a book and read me a few pages? I love the sound of your voice."
"Which book?" I ask when I reach the cabinet.
"My favourite,"
she answers.
"Shit."
I rummage through the books that stand up in my eyes.
"Which one's her favourite?"
But it doesn't matter. Whichever book I pick will be her favourite. "Wuthering Heights," I suggest.
"How did you know?"
"Instinct," I say, and begin reading. She falls asleep on the lounge after a few pages, and I wake her and help her to bed.
"Good night, Jimmy."
"Good night, Miller." As I walk home, something writes itself to the edge of my mind. It's a piece of paper that was in the book, used as a bookmark. It was just a normal thin piece of pad paper, all yellow and old. The date said 1-5-41, and there was one small piece of typically scratchy male writing on it, a bit like my own writing. It said, "Dearest Miller, my soul needs yours. Love, Jimmy." During the next visit, she gets out her old photo albums and we look through them. She constantly points out a man who holds her or kisses her or just stands there on his own.
"You're always so handsome,"
she tells me. She even touches Jimmy's face on the photos, and I see what it is to love someone like Miller loved that man. Her fingertips are made of love. When she speaks, her voice is made of love.
"You've changed quite a bit now, but you still look good. You always were the most handsome boy in town. All the girls said so. Even my mother told me how great you were, how loving and strong, and how I had to do good by you and treat you right."
She looks at me now, almost panic-stricken.
"I did right by you, Jimmy. Didn't I? I treated you right, didn't I?"
I melt. I melt and look her in her old but lovely eyes. "You did right by me, Miller. You treated me right. You were the best wife I could have ever." And that's when she breaks down and cries into my sleeve.
She cries and cries and laughs. She shakes with such despair and joy, and her tears soak nice and warm through to my arm. She offers me mud cake after a while. It's the one I brought her a few days ago.
I can't remember who brought me this, she tells me, but it's very nice. Would you like some, Jimmy?
That'd be great, I say. It's older now and a bit stale, the mud cake, but the taste is perfect. A few nights later, we're all on the porch of the shack, playing cards. I'm going strongly until a sudden silence slits through the game. A sound follows it, from inside. It's the phone, Audrey says. Something about it that doesn't sit right. An uneasy feeling glides over me.
Well, are you getting it?
Marv asks. I get up and step over the doorman with great trepidation. The ring calls me toward it. I pick it up. Quiet. All quiet. Hello? Again. Hello? The voice attempts to find the very core of me. It finds it and says four words. How's it going, Jimmy? Something breaks in me.
What? I ask. What did you say?
You heard me. The phone dies, and I'm alone. I stagger back out to the porch.
You're lost,
Marv informs me, but I barely hear him. I couldn't care less about the card game.
You look shocking, Richie tells me. Sit down, lad.
I heed his advice and take my place again in the game. Audrey looks at me and asks whether I'm okay just by the expression on her face. I answer yes, and when she stays later, I nearly tell her about Miller and Jimmy. I come so close to asking what she thinks about it all, but I already know the answers. Her opinion can't change any of this, so I might as well face up to the fact that I have to go on. I've given Miller the companionship she's been needing, but it's time now to either move on to the next address or go back to Edgar Street. I can still visit her, of course, but it's time now. It's time to move on. That night, I go out walking with the doorman, late. We go down to the cemetery and see my father and wander through the rest of the graves. A flashlight hits us. Security. You know what time it is? The guy asks. He's big and moustached. No idea, I answer. 11 past midnight. Cemetery's closed, mate. I almost walk away, but tonight I can't. I open my mouth and say, I'm wondering, sir. I'm looking for a grave. He looks at me, deciding. Should he help me or not? He goes for yes. What name?
Johnson.
He shakes his head and laughs, a hint of criticism. Do you have any idea how many Johnsons there are in this joint?
No.
A lot. He sniffs at his moustache, as if to erase an itch. It's red.
He's a redhead.
Well, can we give it a go anyway? What sort of dog is that?
Roddy Shepherd Cross.
He stinks a real bloody treat, mate. Don't you wash him?
Of course I do.
Oh! He turns away, screwing up his face.
That's diabolical.
The grave, I ask.
His memory is jogged.
Oh, yeah. Well, we can give it a shot. Any idea where the poor old sap died?
There's no need to be disrespectful.
He stops.
Look, he's getting a bit shirty now.
Do you want my help or not?
All right, I'm sorry.
This way. We walk almost half the cemetery and find a few Johnsons, but not the one I'm after. You're a bit of a fussy bastard, aren't you?
The security guard says at one point.
Won't this one do?
This is Gertrude Johnson.
Who are you after again?
Jimmy. But this time I add something. Wife's name's Miller.
He jolts to a stop, looks at me, and says, Miller? Oh, shit, I think I know that one. I remember the name because she's mentioned on the stone.
He mutters now as we walk quickly to the other end of the graveyard.
Miller, Miller. His flashlight slaps a stone, and it's there. James Johnson, 1917 to 1942, died serving his country. Beloved to Miller Johnson. For a good 10 minutes or so, we stand there with the flashlight burning the grave with light. The whole time, I'm trying to guess where and exactly how he died, and more to the point, realizing that poor old Miller's been without him for 60 years. I can tell. No other man has entered her life. Not the way her Jimmy did. She's been waiting 60 years for Jimmy to come back. And now he has.
9 of Diamonds. The Barefoot Girl.
Still,
I have to move on. Miller's story is beautiful and tragic, but there are other messages to deliver. The next one is 6 Macedoni Street, 5:30 a.m. For a moment I consider going back to Edgar Street, but I'm still too frightened by what I've heard and seen there. I go there once more, just to check that things are still the same. They are. I arrive with the sun on Macedoni Street, mid-October. Overall, this spring has been unusually hot and it's already nice and warm as I hit the hilly street. I see the two-story house standing at the top. Just after 5:30, a lone figure comes from around the side of the house. I think it's a girl but can't be sure because the figure has a hood over its head. It wears red athletic shorts, a hooded grey sweatshirt, but no shoes. It's about 5'9". I sit down between two parked cars, waiting for the figure to come back. When I give up waiting and begin to leave for work, I finally see her, it's definitely a her, come running round the corner. The sweatshirt's off now, tied around her waist, so I can see her face and her hair. She takes me by surprise because we both hit the corner together, from opposite directions. We both stop, momentarily. Her eyes land on me, only for a second. She looks at me, and she has sunshine-colored hair and a ponytail, and clear eyes like water. The mildest blue I've ever seen. Soft lips that form a gentle shape of recognition. And she keeps running. I can only watch as she tilts her head and turns away. Her legs are shaved, making me think I should have known earlier that it was a girl. They're long and lovely. She's one of those girls who are pretty much straight down. Skinny, with a small but well-formed chest. Long back, straight hips, tall legs. Her bare feet are medium-sized and they hit the ground lightly. She's beautiful. She's beautiful. And I'm ashamed. She's 15 if she's a day and I'm being stepped on. I'm being crushed from the inside. Feelings of love and lust fight each other inside me. And I realize I'm drawn instantly to this girl who runs barefoot at 5:30 in the morning. I can't escape it. I walk home and think about what she needs, what I need to deliver. In a way, it's a process of elimination. If she lives in the hills, she doesn't need money. I don't think she needs someone to befriend her either, but who knows? She runs. It's something to do with that. It has to be. Each morning, I'm there, though I hide myself and don't think she sees me. One day, I decide to progress the relationship and follow her. I'm in my jeans, my boots, and an old white t-shirt. And she's way out in front of me. The girl strides. I struggle. When I started running, I felt like I was in the Olympic 400-meter final. Now I feel like exactly what I am, a suburban taxi driver who doesn't exercise enough. I feel pitiful, uncoordinated. My legs labor to lift and drag me forward. My feet feel as though they're plowing the earth, sinking in. I breathe as deeply as I can, but there's a wall in my throat. My lungs are starving. Inside me, I can feel the air climbing the wall to get down there, but it's not enough. Still, I keep running. I have to. She goes to the edge of town to the grounds, where the athletic field is. It's at the bottom of a small valley, so I'm relieved it's a downhill run. It's the coming back that makes me nervous. When we make it to the field, she jumps the fence, peeling off the sweatshirt to leave it hanging there. As for me, I stagger myself back to a walk and collapse under the shade of a tree. The girl does laps. The world does laps around me. A dizziness circles me, and I need to throw up. I'm also dying for a drink, but I can't be bothered going over to the tap. So I'm just there, all sprawled out and sweating profusely.
Christ, Ed, I breathe. You're an unfit bastard, aren't you? Even more than I thought.
I know, I answer.
It's disgraceful.
I know. I also know that I shouldn't just lie here all long and awkward under this tree, but I'm beyond hiding from the girl now. If she sees me, she sees me. I can barely move, let alone hide, and I know I'll be stiff as all hell tomorrow. She stops for a while and stretches as the air finally breaks through to reach my lungs properly. Her right leg is up on the fence. It's long and lovely. Don't think about it. Don't think about it, I tell myself. Halfway through those thoughts, she notices me but looks immediately away. She tilts her head and sends her eyes to the ground. Exactly like the other morning. Just for that second. It makes me see that she'll never come to me. I understand this as she takes the leg off the fence and changes to the other. I'll have to go to her. When she stops stretching and reaches for a sweatshirt, I climb from the ground and make my way toward her. She begins to run, but stops. She knows. I think she can feel that I'm here for her. We're about 6 or 7 meters apart now. I look at her, and she looks at the ground about a yard or so from my right ankle. Hello? I say. The stupidity of my voice feels beyond repair. There's a pause. A breath.
Hi,
she says back. Her eyes are still focused on the ground beside me. I take one step, no more. I'm Ed.
I know,
she says.
Ed Kennedy.
Her voice is high-pitched, but soft. So soft you could fall down into it. It reminds me of Melanie Griffith. You know that soft, high voice she's got? That's what the girl has, too. How do you know who I am? I ask.
My dad reads the paper, and I saw your picture after the bank robbery, you know?
I walk forward. I know. Some time etches past, and she finally looks up at me properly.
Why are you following me?
I stand there, among my tiredness, and speak. I'm not sure yet.
You're not a pervert or something, are you?
No!
I'm thinking, don't look at her legs. Don't look at her legs. She looks back to me now and gives me the same look of recognition as the other day.
Well, that's a relief. I saw you nearly every day.
Her voice is so sweet, it's almost ridiculous. It's like strawberry-flavored or something, that voice. I'm sorry if I scared you. Warily, she dares to allow me a smile.
It's okay. It's just, I'm not too good at talking to people.
She looks away again as her shyness smothers her.
So, do you think it'd be all right if we don't talk?
She hurries her words now to not hurt me.
I mean, I don't mind if you're out here in the morning with me, but I just can't talk, okay? I feel kind of uncomfortable.
I nod and hope she sees. No worries.
Thank you.
She gives the ground a final look, takes her sweatshirt and gives me one last question.
You're not much of a runner, are you?
I savor that voice for a moment. It tastes like strawberry on my lips. Maybe this is the last time I'll ever hear it. Then, no, I'm not. I say, and we exchange a final few seconds of acknowledgement before she runs away. I watch her and hear her bare feet lightly touching the earth. I like that sound. It reminds me of her voice. I go out to the athletic field every morning before I head off for work, and she's there. Every day, without fail. One morning the rain pours down and she's still there. On a Wednesday, I take a day off work, telling myself it's the kind of sacrifice you're required to make when you've got a higher calling. With the doorman in tow, I walk to the school at around 3 o'clock. She comes out with a few friends, which gladdens me because I hope she wouldn't be alone. Her shyness made me worry about that. It's funny how when you watch people from a long distance, it all seems voiceless. It's like watching a silent movie. You guess what people say. You watch their mouths move and imagine the sounds of their feet hitting the ground. You wonder what they're talking about and, even more so, what they might be thinking. The strange thing I notice as I watch is that when a boy comes along and talks to the girls and walks with them, the running girl shifts back into the mode of looking to the ground. When he leaves, she's all right again. I stand and wonder for a while and conclude that she probably just lacks confidence, like me. She probably feels too tall and gawky, not realizing how beautiful everyone knows she is. I think if it's only that, she'll be okay soon enough. I shake my head. At myself. Listen to you, I tell me, saying she'll be okay. How the hell would you know? Is it because you've turned out okay, Ed? I very much doubt it. I'm absolutely right. I have no business plotting or predicting anything for this girl. I only have to do what I'm supposed to do and hope it'll be enough. A few times I watch her house at night. Nothing happens. Ever. As I stand there and contemplate the girl and old Miller and the dread of Edgar Street, I realize I don't even know this girl's name. For some reason I imagine it to be something like Allison, but mostly I just think of her as the running girl. I go to the athletics meet that's on every weekend during summer. She's there, and I find her sitting with the rest of her family. There's a younger girl and a small boy. They all wear black shorts and a light blue tank top with a rectangular patch sewn on the back. The girl's patch has number 176 on it, just under the slogan that says, "You've got to be made of Milo." The under-15's 1500 meters is called, and she stands up, brushing dried grass from her shorts. "Good luck," her mother says. "Yeah, good luck, Sophie," the father echoes.
Sophie? I like it. I hear it in my mind and place the name carefully to her face.
It fits nicely. She's still brushing the grass from her shorts when I remember the other two kids even exist. Once they were gone, I was able to focus completely on Sophie. The girl's out doing shot put, and the boy's gone off somewhere to play army men with an ugly little bastard named Kieran.
Can I go with Kieran, Mum? Please?
All right, but make sure you're listening out for your events. The 70 metres is coming up.
Okay, let's go, Kieran.
For a moment, I feel glad to be called Simple No Problems Ed. Not Edward, Edmund, Edwin. Just Ed. Sheer mediocrity feels nice for a change. Sophie sees me once she stands up, and a small piece of contentment finds itself on her face. She looks happy to see me, but she still turns from me almost straight away. She walks to the marshalling area with a pair of crappy old spike shoes in her hand. I assume the older kids are allowed to wear them in the longer races, when her father calls out again.
Hey, Soph.
She turns to face him.
I know you can win it, if you want it.
Thanks, Dad.
She walks hurriedly away, turning once more to where I sit in the sun, shoving a lamington into my mouth. There's a coconut sprinkle stuck to the side of my lips, but it's too late to remove it. She wouldn't see it anyway, not from that distance. She only gives me a quick glance and goes on. I know what I have to do now. If I was a cocky sort of guy, I'd tell you this one's a piece of piss. A snack. But I'm not. I can't bring myself to say it because I still think of Edgar Street. I realize that for every good message, there will always be one that will agonize me. So I'm thankful for this. It's a nice day, and I like this girl. I like her even more when she runs alongside another tall and skinny girl who always looks like she's got the wood on her. They run together, but at the end, the other girl finishes more strongly. Her stride lengthens, and a man keeps yelling, "Go, Annie! Go, Annie! Dig 'em in, love! Dig 'em in! Beat her, darling! You can do it!" I'd rather come in second than have shit like that yelled at me. Sophie's father is different. For the race, he goes down to the fence and watches intently. He yells nothing, only watches. At times, I can sense some tension in him as he wills his daughter ahead of the other girl. When the other one nudges ahead, he looks briefly over to the other father, but that's all. When she wins, he applauds her, and he applauds Sophie too. The other father only stands there with obscene pride, as if it was he who had just run his stomach out and won the race. When Sophie comes and stands next to her father, he puts his arm around her. Her disappointment is written heavily across her shoulders. In a way, Sophie's dad reminds me of my own father, except my own father never put his arm around me. Not to mention he was an alcoholic. It's in his mannerisms and his quietness. My own father was a quiet man who never had a bad word for anyone. He'd go to the pub and stay there till closing. He'd walk the streets to sober up, but it never quite worked. Still, I must say, he'd get up and make it to work the next day without fail. My ma would rant and rave and scream abuse at him for being out, but he never reacted. He never told her off in return. Sophie's father looks the same, except for the alcoholic part. In short, he looks like a gentleman. They walk back to the mother together and sit there on the hill. The father and mother hold hands as Sophie drinks one of those sports drinks. They look like the type of family who tell each other they love each other when they go to bed, and when they wake up, and before they go to work. The spiked shoes come off Sophie's feet. She looks at them and sighs. I thought these were meant to be good luck. I can only assume they've been handed down from her mother or perhaps another successful relative. As they sit on the ground, I take a closer look at those shoes. They're a faded blue and yellow. They're old and worn through. And they're wrong. The girl deserves better. 10 of Diamonds. The Shoebox. Haven't seen you for a while. I've been busy. Audrey and I are on my front porch, drinking cheap alcohol, as usual. The doorman comes out and asks for some, but I give him a big pat instead.
You still getting those cards in the mail?
She knew all along, of course, that I was lying about throwing out the diamonds. No one in their right mind would throw diamonds out, would they? They're valuable. If anything, they need protecting.
Miller, I think. Sophie. The woman on Edgar Street and her daughter, Angelina.
No, I'm still on the first one.
Do you think there'll be more?
I think about it and can't figure out if I want another one or not. First one's hard enough. We drink. I drop in regularly at Miller's place and she shows me her photos again and I continue reading from Wuthering Heights. I'm actually starting to like it. The cake got finished a few nights ago, thank God, but the old lady's as nice as ever. Shaky as hell, but nice as ever. Sophie loses again the next week at athletics, this time in the 800. She doesn't run the same in those patchy old shoes.
She needs something better to even come close to how she runs in the mornings. That's when she's true. She's apart, almost out of herself.
Early next Saturday morning, I go to her house and knock on the door. Her father answers.
Can I help you?
I feel nervous, like I've come to convince him to let his daughter go out with me. I'm holding a shoebox in my right hand, and the man looks down at it. Quickly, I lift it and say, I've got a delivery for your daughter Sophie. I hope they're the right size. The shoebox passes between our hands, and the man looks confused.
Just tell her a guy brought her some new shoes.
The man looks at me as if I'm heavily intoxicated.
Okay.
He tries his hardest not to mock me.
I will.
Thank you. I turn around and start walking away, but he brings me back.
Wait,
he calls out.
Yes, sir?
He holds the box out, puzzled, lifting it into the conversation.
I know, I say.
The box is empty.
I haven't shaved, and I feel like death warmed up at the track. I didn't bring the cab in till 6 this morning and went straight over to Sophie's place and over to the track. I've got a sausage roll for breakfast and some coffee. She gets called for the 1500, and she goes barefoot. I smile at the thought of it. Barefoot shoes. Just don't let her get stepped on, I say. A few minutes later, her father approaches the fence. The race begins. The other dickhead starts yelling out. And Sophie gets tripped up on the back straight after a lap. She falls among the lead group of five, and the rest of them stretch out, up to maybe 25 meters in front. When she gets back up, it reminds me of that bit in Chariots of Fire when Eric Liddell falls over and runs past everyone to win. There are two laps to run, and she's still well behind. She gets the first two runners easily, and she's running like she does in the morning. There's no strain. The only thing you can see on her is a feeling of freedom and the purest sense that she's alive. All she needs is the hood and the red pants. Her bare feet carry her past the third one, and soon she's up alongside her nemesis. She goes past her and holds her with 200 to go. Just like the mornings, I think, and people have stopped to watch. They saw her fall and stand and keep going. Now they watch her out in front, beyond everything that's ever been done on a normal weekend in this town. The discus has stopped, and the high jump. Everything has. All there is the girl with the sunshine hair and the killer voice, breathing and being in front. The other girl comes at her. She pushes for the lead. There's blood on Sophie's knees from the fall. And she also got spiked, I think. But this is how it has to be. The last 100 meters nearly kill her. I can see the pain tightening on her face. Her bare feet bleed on their way across the balding grass. She almost smiles from the pain, from the beauty of it. She's out of herself. Barefoot. More alive than anyone I've ever witnessed. They run at the line. And the other girl wins. Like always. As they go over the line, Sophie collapses, and down there, on the ground, she rolls onto her back and looks up at the sky. There's ache in her arms and ache in her legs and heart, but on her face is the beauty of the morning, and for the first time, I think, she recognizes it. 5:30 a.m. Sophie's father claps, like always, only this time, he's not alone. The other girl's father claps now, too.
That's a hell of a daughter you got there, he says.
Sophie's father only nods modestly and says, Thank you. So have you.
Jack of Diamonds, another stupid human.
I throw my styrofoam coffee cup in the bin with my sausage roll wrapper and begin to walk away. As usual, I've got sauce all stuck on my fingers. I can hear her feet behind me, but I don't turn around. I want to hear her voice.
Ed?
It's unmistakable. I turn around and smile at a girl who's got blood on her knees and feet. From her left knee, it runs crookedly down her shin. I point to it and say, You better get that looked after. Calmly, she answers,
I will.
Some discomfort stands between us now, and I know I don't belong here anymore. Her hair's out and it's beautiful. Her eyes are worth drowning in, and her mouth speaks to me. I just, she says, wanted to say thanks.
For getting you spiked and hurt?
No, she refuses my lie.
Thanks, Ed. I give in. It's a pleasure.
My voice sounds like gravel compared to hers. When I step closer, I notice she doesn't look away from me now. She doesn't tilt her head or send her eyes to the ground. She lets herself look and be with me. "You've got beauty," I tell her. "You know that, don't you?" Her face goes a little red as she accepts it.
"Will I see you again?"
she asks. And to be honest, I think I'll regret what I say next. Not at 5:30 in the bloody morning. She twists on one of her feet, laughing silently to herself. I'm about to leave when she asks,
"Ed?"
"Sophie?" It shocks her that I know her name, but she goes on.
"Are you some kind of saint or something?"
Inside, I laugh.
Me? A saint?
I list what I am. Taxi driver, local deadbeat, cornerstone of mediocrity, sexual midget, pathetic card player. I say my final words to her. "No, I'm not a saint, Sophie. I'm just another stupid human." We smile a last smile, and I walk away. I feel her watching me, but I don't look back.
Queen of Diamonds, Edgar Street Revisited. Feels like the mornings clap their hands to make me wake. In the mornings of my eyes, I see three things each time. Miller, Sophie, 45 Edgar Street. The first two hold me up with the rising of the sun. The third strips me and hands shivers to my skin and to my flesh and bones. I spend the late of each night watching repeats of Dukes of Hazzard. The big fat guy always sits there eating marshmallows at his desk.
"What's that bloke's name again?"
I asked myself when I saw the first episode. Then Daisy came on screen and said,
"What's up, Boss Hogg?"
Boss Hogg. Of course. God, Daisy looks fantastic in her tight jeans. Each night when I see her, my pulse quickens immeasurably. But she's always gone quicker than she arrives. The doorman shoots me a dirty look every time.
"I know," I say. But then she comes on again and there's no point arguing. Beautiful women are the torment of my existence. The knights and dukes pass by. I drive my cab with a headache that waits behind me. Every time I turn around, it's there. "Thanks, mate," I say. "That'll be $16.50.
$16.50?
Whinges the old guy in his suit. His words are like froth in my head, boiling, rising and falling. "Just pay up. I don't have the patience for this today. You can walk next time if it costs too much." I'm sure he puts it on his company's account anyway. He gives me the money and I thank him. Wasn't so difficult now, was it? I think. He slams the door hard. My head may as well have been in it. In a way, I'm waiting for another phone call to arrive at my place, telling me to get over to Edgar Street again, pronto. I wait a few nights, but there's nothing. On Thursday night, I leave the card game at Audrey's early. A feeling clutters me. It makes me stand up and leave, almost without saying a word. The time has arrived, and I know I need to be standing outside that house at the end of Edgar Street, a house held up by the violence that occurs inside it almost every night. As I walk there, I realize I'm hurrying. I've had the success I felt I needed. Miller and Sophie. Now, I have to face this. I turn onto Edgar Street, forming fists inside my jacket pockets. I check to see that no one's watching me. With Miller and Sophie, I always felt at ease. They were the nice ones. There was practically no risk involved, unlike here, where all the answers seemed to be painful ones. For the wife and the girl and for the husband. And me. Waiting, I pull a forgotten piece of chewing gum from my pocket and put it in my mouth. It tastes like sickness, like fear. The feeling escalates when the man comes down the road and walks up the porch steps. Silence moves closer then. It clips me, pushing past. It happens. The violence interferes. It sticks its fingers into everything and tears it open. It all comes apart, and I loathe myself for waiting this long to end it. I despise myself for taking the easy options night after night. A hatred is wound up and let go in me. It hacks at my spirit and brings it to its knees next to me. It coughs and suffocates as my own hatred for myself becomes overwhelming. The door, I tell myself. Go to the door. It's open. But I don't move. I don't move because my cowardice tramples me, even as I try to lift my spirit from its knees. It only keels over. It sways off to the side and hits the earth with a silent, beaten thud. It looks up at the stars.
They're stars that dribble across the sky.
Go,
I tell myself again, and this time I walk on. Everything shakes as I walk up the porch steps and stand at the door. Distant clouds watch me, but they're backing away. The world wants nothing to do with this. I don't blame it. Inside, I hear them. He's waking her in every moment, disturbing her, reaching through her and abandoning her at the same time. He throws her down and takes her and cuts her open. The bed springs leak, a howling, desperate noise of falling down and springing up, even though they don't want to. Refusal is pointless. Complaint has no use. Some crying crawls to the doorway where I stand. It hobbles out from the gap in the door and lands at my feet.
How can you not go in?
I ask myself, but still I wait. The door opens a little more, and a presence stands there now, opposite me. It's the girl. The girl is in front of me, planting her fist in her eye to wrestle out the sleep that has lodged there. She wears yellow pajamas with red boats on them, and her toes curl and rub together. She looks at me, but without fear. Anything's better than where she's coming from. In a whisper, she asks,
Who are you?
I'm Ed, I whisper back.
I'm Angelina,
she says.
Are you here to save us?
I can see a tiny spark of hope awaken in her eyes. I crouch down to look at her properly. I want to tell her I am, but nothing comes out. I can see that the silence from my mouth has all but extinguished the hope she has conjured up. It's almost gone when I finally speak. I look at her truthfully and say, You're right, Angelina. I'm here to save you. She steps closer as it rekindles.
Can you?
She asks with surprise.
Really?
Even a girl of about 8 years can see there's almost no rescue from her life. She has to double check if she can believe me. I'll try, I say. And the girl smiles. She smiles and hugs me and says,
Thanks, Ed.
She turns around now and points. Her voice whispers even quieter.
It's the first room on the right.
If only it was that easy.
Well, come on, Ed,
she says.
They're just in there.
But again, I don't move. The fear has tied itself round my feet, and I know there's nothing I can do. Not tonight. Not ever, it seems. If I try to move, I'll trip over it. I expect the girl to scream at me. Something like,
But you promised, Ed! You promised!
She says nothing, though. I think she understands how physically powerful her father is and how scrawny I am. All she does is stumble over to me and hug me again. The girl tries to crawl inside my jacket as the noise from the bedroom reaches us from inside. She hugs me so tight I wonder how her bones survive. When she lets go and leaves, she says,
Thanks for at least trying, Ed.
I answer nothing because the only thing I feel now is shame. I watch her feet as they turn and walk away beneath the yellow pajamas. She turns once more and says,
Goodbye, Ed.
Goodbye, I say through my curtain of shame. She closes the door completely, and I crouch there. I allow myself to fall forward and rest my head on the doorframe. My breath bleeds. My heartbeat drowns my ears. I'm in bed now, swallowed by the night. How can a person sleep when all he can feel are the arms of a tiny kid in yellow pajamas holding on to him in the dark? It's impossible. I feel insanity will come after me soon. If I don't get back down to Edgar Street in the next few nights, I fear I might go crazy. If only the kid didn't come out. But I knew she would. Or at least I should have known. She'd always come out before and cried on the porch, followed later by her mother. I know as I lie here, flat on my back, that I'd meant to meet her. I wanted her to give me the courage, to force me inside. But it failed miserably. In fact, it couldn't have been more disastrous. Now a worse feeling empties itself into me. At 2:27 a.m., the phone rings. It shocks through the air, and I jump up, run to it, look at it. This can't be good. Hello? The voice at the other end waits. Hello? I say again. It finally speaks, and I can picture it now, mouthing the words. The voice is dry, permanently cracked. It's friendly enough, but it still means business. It says,
Check your letterbox, Ed.
The silence overhauls us, and the voice leaves me completely. There's no more breathing at the other end. I hang up and walk slowly out my front door and over to the letterbox. The stars are gone completely now, and a haze of rain is falling as each of my footsteps step me closer. My hand shivers as I bend down and open the latch. I reach in. I touch something cold and heavy. My finger touches the trigger. I shudder. King of Diamonds. Murder at the Cathedral. There's only the one bullet in the gun. One bullet for one man, and this is where I feel like the unluckiest person on earth. I tell myself, "You're a cab driver, Ed. How in the hell did you end up in all this mess? You should have just stayed on the floor in that bank." I'm sitting at my kitchen table with a gun warming up in my hand. The doorman's awake and demanding coffee, and all I can do is stare at the gun. It also doesn't help that whoever's setting all this up gives me just the one bullet. Don't they realize I'm most likely to shoot off one of my own feet before I even get started? I don't know. This has gone too far now. A gun, for God's sake. I can't kill anyone. For starters, I'm a coward. Second, I'm weak. Third, the day of the bank robbery was obviously a fluke. Nobody's ever even showed me how to use a gun. I'm angry now. Why have I been chosen for this? I beg, despite knowing without question what I have to do. You were happy with the other two, I castigate myself, so now you have to do this one. What if I don't do it? Maybe the person on the phone will come after me. Maybe that's what it's all about. Maybe it's a case of either I do the job or the rest of the bullets wind up inside me. Shit, I can't sleep now. I'm about to have a hernia, for Jesus' sake. I look through the old record collection my dad gave me. Stress relief. I shuffle through the albums feverishly and find what I'm looking for. The Proclaimers. I chuck it on and watch it spin. The ridiculous first notes of 500 Miles come on, and I feel like going berserk. Even the Proclaimers are giving me the shits tonight. This scene's an abomination. I pace the room. The doorman looks at me as if I'm insane. I am insane. It's official. It's 3 in the morning, I'm playing the Proclaimers too loud for their own bloody good, and I'm pretty sure I have to go and kill someone. My life has really become worthwhile, hasn't it? A gun. A gun. Those words shoot through me, and I constantly look at it to check this is real. White light from the kitchen stretches into the lounge room, and the doorman's paws reach out and lightly scratch me, asking for a pat. "Piss off, doorman," I spit, but his huge brown eyes plead for me to calm down. I break and pat him on the stomach, apologize, and make us some coffee. There's no way I'm sleeping tonight. The Proclaimers are just warming up on that Misery to Happiness song, the follow-up to 500 Miles. Insomnia must kill people, I think, as I drive the cab back from the city. It's the next day. My eyes are itchy and burning as I drive with the window down. The warmth of the air feeds on my eyes, but I let it. The gun is under my mattress where I left it last night. I've got the gun under the mattress and the card in my drawer. It's hard to tell which has cursed me more. I tell myself to stop whinging. Back at the vacant taxis lot, I see Audrey kissing one of the new blokes who works there. He's about my height, but obviously goes to the gym. Their tongues touch and massage each other. His hands are on her hips, and hers are in the back pocket of his jeans. Lucky I don't have the gun now, I think, but I know I'm all talk. "Hi, Audrey," I say as I walk by, but she doesn't hear me. I'm heading to the office to see my boss, Jerry Boston. Jerry's a particularly obese man with greasy hair combed over his bald spot. I knock on his door.
"Come in,"
he calls out.
"It's about time you..."
He stops mid-sentence.
I thought you were Marge. She was supposed to bring me some coffee half an hour ago."
I saw Marge smoking a cigarette in the car park, but choose not to mention it. I like Marge, and it's not the sort of thing I like to get involved in. The door closes behind me, and Jerry and I watch each other.
"Well?"
he asks.
"What?"
"Sir, I'm Ed Kennedy, and I drive one of your..."
"Fascinating. What do you want?"
"My brother's moving house today," I lie, "and I was wondering if I could take my cab home to drive a few things over to his new place." He looks at me generously and says,
"Now why on earth would I let you do that?"
He's smiling.
"Do my taxis have removalists painted on the doors? Do I look like a charity to you?"
He's irritated now.
"Buy your own car, for Christ's sake."
I remain calm, but move closer. Sir, I've driven night and day sometimes, and I've never taken a holiday. To be honest, due to my 9-month